If you've listened to the interview about the Mount Osborne rescue, which we put out in May, and that includes rescue from a couple climbers on a mountain just north of Nome, we were missing one of the key players in the episode, and that was the helicopter pilot, Corey Connick. He was down collecting one of Bering Air's new MD-500s from Arizona at the time, and obviously couldn't sit down with us. So I had a chance later on to sit down with Corey, and we ended up not talking so much about the rescue, but more about helicopter careers in general, which was great, because helicopters have been a fascination of mine for a long time. I somehow ended up with about 12 and a half hours in Bell 47s, partly because a friend of mine started a company down in just north of Seattle called Cascade West Helicopters, running a Bell 47. He had a series of misfortunes at that time, and the company didn't last, which is too bad, because that took out my path to cheap helicopter flight time and possibly helicopter rating. Nonetheless, I stayed super interested in helicopters, but they're really cool. And I think all helicopter flying can certainly be classified as oddball. There's, without exception, even the more mainstream helicopter flying, such as air ambulance, is still non-conventional by most flying standards. So to sit down with Corey was quite a treat. I managed to catch up with him here in Nome over the Bering Air Hangar, and we also got a chance to look at their new 500s, which is pretty cool. And Corey had an interesting career, sort of a different start to it, starting fixed wing, but really moving into helicopters pretty quickly. And I think you can almost say it's a standard for non-conventional starts to a career. But really nice guy, and lots of good information on how to get into helicopters. And his career is obviously still advancing, although I think he's found a pretty good home at Bering Air, and he may be there for a while. Like many helicopter jobs, despite the fact he's based in Nome, which is a fairly local area, he still ends up away from home quite a bit in the summer. And so I've run into him since then down in Unicleet, where he was spending some time on some contracts, and more recently over in Gullivan, where he was doing some more contracts. So the flying's always challenging with helicopters and interesting. If you're interested in hearing more about what helicopter jobs are like, then listen to what Corey has to say. He's got a lot of good information, despite the fact he's a fairly modest guy and wouldn't toot his own horn too much. I hope you enjoy it. This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting down with Corey in Nome, Alaska. Corey flies helicopters for Bering Air. And Bering Air, if you guys have been following, is a company here in Nome, and we interviewed Ben Rowe last summer. And Bering Air has been flying in Nome, operating out of Nome since the 70s, I believe it was, from that interview. And recently they moved into the helicopter world, starting with one R-44. And as they expanded the fleet, they started hiring full-time helicopter pilots. And Corey is the first full-time helicopter pilot for Bering Air, I believe. Is that correct?
We had Terry Day.
Oh, Terry, but he was also fixed-wing.
He was fixed-wing also, but he was, between the helicopter pilots, there was Terry, Russ, and Ben.
And but, Brian Weckworth for a couple months.
But I guess you could say I'm the first full-time helicopter pilot they hired from outside the company.
Okay, that makes sense. So how did you get into flying helicopters? When did you first know you wanted to fly helicopters?
Being a passenger in the military on various different helicopters, it was always interesting. And I'd always wanted to fly since I was a kid.
Okay.
And airplanes always were interesting. Helicopters just seemed that much more interesting. They just seemed pretty awesome to be able to do what they do. And when I got out of the military, I was able to start to make that happen.
So you didn't fly in the military.
No.
You were enlisted?
Mm-hmm.
Grunt?
Yeah. I was in the infantry.
Okay, and you fly, you were based over in?
Various different places. Okay. I was, a different place in the U.S. I did some time in Afghanistan.
Okay. Yeah. So you were flying in at Pave Hawks now?
Blackhawks, yep. So I was in Blackhawks, Chinooks. I was really disappointed when I was in Afghanistan. One of our guys in our platoon, he happened to be in the chow line next to one of the Cobra pilots, the Marine Cobra pilots that were there. And they started talking. Needless to say, that guy was able to get a ride in the Cobra at our fire base that we were at and took some video. And I looked back on that and I was like, I wish I could have done that. I'm, of course, jealous. But then I wish I could have done that with the knowledge that I have now, because then I would have definitely, if I was in that position, understood what was going on.
That was in the Marine Corps a long time ago, back in the late 80s. And we had a tour of a Cobra. We had a Cobra pilot give us a little tore up, and I wasn't aware they were still operating.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they are. The Cobras are still operational.
Oh, yeah. Cobras, they have the two-bladed model still, and now they have the four-bladed Zulu model.
That's awesome.
Both the Hueys and Cobra. Yeah,
that's cool. So I've seen this with a lot of helicopter pilots that a lot of fixed-wing pilots just wanted to fly,
mm-hmm.
and they gravitate towards whatever gets them in the air. A lot of friends I have to fly helicopters, they specifically want to fly helicopters because they'd had a job where they got to fly in helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And the military is obviously a place where you have a lot of exposure to helicopters. So when you got out of the military, you wanted to fly helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
Did you go straight into the helicopter program, or did you fly fixed-wing first?
No, I was in that category that you're saying, and I just wanted to fly, so I went into fixed wing. And maybe about two-thirds into my fixed wing training, which took about a year because I would fly a little, take a break, fly a little. I liked it, but I guess I wasn't as serious as I thought I was going to be.
Right.
And I did an introductory flight down at Alpine Air in Girdwood. They had an R-22, just one at the time, and that was in March of 06, and it was hook, line, and sinker. So I ended up finishing up my fixed-wing license that June of 06.
Okay.
And then starting in late September of 06, I did, you know, I crunched the numbers, went through the finances, and said, okay, fixed-wing's fun, but I want to go to helicopters. And so I actually stopped working and devoted all my time try and knock it out as quick as I can, albeit still staying in Alaska. I didn't want to make the big jump to go to one of these fake factory schools.
Right.
So I just did lessons out of Birchwood and started with my private and then my commercial helicopter license.
Who'd you do your flight training with? Name of the flight school?
It was Alpine Air's offshoot. It was Alaska Helicopters.
Okay, that's what I was thinking. I'd heard they had a thing in Birchwood when mm-hmm. they were running some helicopters. So you did all your training with Alpine Air.
I was in a roundabout way with Alpine Air for quite a number of years. Yeah.
Okay. so that's how it, you know, I always try to piece together this progression. So you were doing fixed wing out of Anchorage mm-hmm. at like Take Flight or somewhere.
Actually, with Rick Roos, Arctic Flyers out of Lake Hood.
Oh, okay.
He did my, I got my private with him. Who?
Cool.
He's one of those guys that either, you know, people like or maybe don't like. I thought he was great. I like Rick's a hoot.
Okay.
He's awesome. So
he's just running a Part 91 or 61 flight school.
Yeah. Yep.
And a Cub or what?
No, they had he has a couple 150s, 152s, 172, and Taylor Craft.
Okay, I haven't heard of him.
If you're looking for anybody ever to interview and you want a very interesting person,
I will look him up because that's one, and a couple of years ago I really started looking into this and I sort of dropped the ball and didn't continue, different types of flight school.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked to a woman who's at Emory Riddle now, which is, of course, one version of a flight school. And then the opposite side was kind of what I did. I just found an instructor I liked at a small flight school, and I thought that was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a lot of that. I just talked to one of our members in England, who's just got his JAR.
Mm-hmm.
We did the JAR a while ago, just got it recurrent, and it's just interesting to see these different ways of doing flight training.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I think it comes out of an instructor's.
Yeah, I love flying with Rick. I mean, because he was a smaller operation, I couldn't continue on with some of the other things that I was hoping to accomplish with him.
Right.
Which I was disappointed. I would fly with him any day of the week. He was always a blast. And his family, his dad, Herman Roos, was, well-known in the area.
So like an old...
Aviation came in the family.
Yeah.
His mom, her name's escaping me right now, but she was a Czech airman and an instructor as well. So, I mean, it was in the family. They had this small little cabin on Lake Hood, one of the fingers, that they did instruction. It was a real kind of family atmosphere where here are the keys to the plane, here are the keys to the... once he knew you, once he trusted you, here are the keys to the cabin. I would go to the cabin and just sit there and study at like midnight just to get away from things. It was quiet and I knew nobody would interrupt me.
That's a good Alaskan approach too.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool.
So if you didn't want to talk to an instructor, I would try to track him down. I like Rick a lot.
Yeah. I will look him up.
Very eccentric. he's got an interesting personality, but like I said, I always enjoyed flying with him.
Yeah. I will look him up. Does he rent out planes too?
I believe so.
That might, yeah, that always good to have a plane to buzz around in.
I think all he has, he's real happy with like 150s, 152s,
That's fine. It's small.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, see, whenever I get into these interviews, I start finding out all kinds of stuff that I never thought I'd even find out. So, are you from Anchorage originally?
No. Other than born in Canada, I grew up in Southern California, actually.
Okay.
And I didn't come up to Alaska until 11 years now. I came up with the military.
Okay, so you're based up here and you like
that. Fort Richardson,
Okay, cool.
Yeah. I was given the option of Louisiana or Alaska, and I'd already lived in the South, and I never wanted to live there again.
Hot, humid.
Yes, and I'd always wanted to come to Alaska. When I was a kid, I used to bring books home to my dad saying that, hey, this looks great, let's move to Alaska. And so when this opportunity came to move to Alaska, you know, and somebody was paying for it, I was like...
Jumped on it.
Yeah.
That's cool. So back to the flight training, so you... When you I know the Lakehood training, the GI Bill wouldn't pay for, but that'd be Part 61. But the helicopter stuff at Alpine Air, is that a...
No, I didn't pay for that either, but I was able to... I don't know if it would be a loophole or what you'd call it. I was also taking classes at UAA.
Okay.
And in a semester of classes I was taking, maybe it would cost about $2,000 to $3,000. I forget what the cost was, but it was enough where... The GI Bill that I would receive for a semester was maybe like $6,000 or $7,000.
Right.
So that rest of that money would help towards flying. And I had saved stuff up. I had in the military, and, you know, so I had savings. So I was ready for it. The GI Bill didn't pay for it solely, but it helped.
Right. Yeah. So that's a creative way of keeping the making the GI Bill work for you.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not scamming the system because I still use it for college, so it worked perfect.
Right, yeah.
Actually furthered education in a roundabout way.
It probably cost less. I know there are a lot of flight schools down south, the 141 schools, they had people on the GI Bill who had pay for all their training, I believe. And then, you know, they use the system the way it should be used, but they'll extend it as far as they can. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I got my helicopter rating. Well, I'm going to do my multi-fixed wing now as well because it's still going to be paid for. So you just used in a creative way and probably finished up quicker.
Yeah, I was able to knock out my commercial fairly quickly, commercial helicopter. And let's see, I started in September of 2006, and I had my commercial by June of 2007. And for a flight school that only had one instructor, one helicopter, and he only worked 3 days a week, and I did most of it in the winter in Alaska, I thought that wasn't too bad of timing.
Not bad at all.
Yeah. I had lucked out because in one of those right places at the right time, the owner of the flight school at Alpine Air, he bought two R-44s at different times, one in February, one in May, and I was able to do the ferry flights for both of those, and that built a good chunk of that 150 hours that I needed.
That would, yeah. So, yeah, I knew Alpine Air. I lived, spent a summer in Girdwood, and they were fixed wing then. Mm-hmm. They hadn't switched over. Do you think doing that fixed wing rating prior to the rotorcraft helped with the rotorcraft? Or that's a common, you know, we're talking about that a little bit downstairs. That's a common thought. Does getting a fixed wing rating help or not in terms of getting a rotorcraft?
The common knowledge material, just your airmanship, your basic navigation, airspace, all that. That is helpful because hopefully you have a base there and you can kind of breeze through that when you're getting the add-on. But, overall flying, I mean, aerodynamics, you have the fundamentals, but really you just need to get behind the stick of something different to actually understand it, in this case the helicopter. Because what I would tell all my students when I was an instructor, and I'm a CFI in both airplanes and helicopters, but more in helicopters, obviously. With the airplane, you're always making those subtle movements. We're always told, you know, don't over control, right? But in reality, you're still... moving that yoke around where you can visually see that you're moving it. With the helicopter, I always tell my students, don't think of moving the controls, just think of pressures. I mean, there will be times, obviously, in auto-rotation stuff, you need to move things, but just in basic everyday flying, don't think of movements, think of pressures. And once the students start to understand that, and once I started to understand that back when I was a student, it was just like anything, learning anything else, and then finally it clicking one day.
I told you I've got my 12 hours in the Bell 47, which is nothing. And the one thing I walked away from it, though, is like you're saying, it's pressures and it's almost The closest aviation wise I can think of is like a tail dragger,
mm-hmm.
where you're always on the rudders,
mm-hmm.
but you almost have to be hitting the correct rudder before the plane's making the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the helicopter, you need to be responding. If you see you're moving left, it's already too late.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get 180 degrees off.
Mm-hmm.
Like I need a right cyclic movement, I'm moving it left. And it just seems like you need to get this more intuitive feel, like, okay, I'm starting to feel it, and you're just making these very subtle movements.
Yeah, it's fixed-wing flying, a lot of it's visual.
Right.
But helicopter, it's taken to a new level.
Right.
With helicopters. What I would tell students is, okay, basic hovering lessons. We go out, and we go out on the runway, and the goal was, say, just keep the nose pointed down the runway, and we're just going to, you know, I'm going to come off the cyclic, and you have to stop it from oscillating, try and hold it in a spot, or even just creep forward, but don't let it oscillate all over the place.
Or go backwards.
Or backwards. Yeah. And what I would tell them is, don't think of, if you see the helicopter going right, don't move that cyclic to the left. Because what's going to happen is you're going to move it to the left, and already you're going to start chasing it to the left. Then you're going to chase it back to the right, and then your oscillations keep getting worse and worse.
Exactly what I do.
The analogy I would give them was, if you're driving down the road in a car, you know, say a two-lane highway or multiple-lane highway, and, you know, you look down for a second, you look back up, you realize you started veering into the lane next to you. You don't think about, oh, I need to turn that wheel back over to get back in my lane. You just do it subconsciously because you've been driving, right? This is what we're teaching you in the helicopter, where don't think of you have to give that movement back in that direction. Just react to what you're seeing outside and just give that pressure in the opposite direction. So,
right.
And, you know, of course, that comes with time and practice, but that's what we're shooting for. And so it just becomes second nature to get back to wherever it is you're trying to do.
Right. It just takes time. And fixed wing time does not help with that, because it's a totally different, and I concur, it's you're using two hands and your feet,
mm-hmm.
all simultaneously, mm-hmm. and it's like patting your, you know, stomach and rubbing your head, or the other way around. Mm-hmm. And once, my feeling is, from what I brief moment where I had a huffer working, is that once you get it, it's kind of like, okay, I think I got it.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're, and that was my thought, and I never, until I make a bigger effort at helicopters, I guess I won't really know, but there's something to be said for being comfortable in the environment that you get from fixed wing, understanding traffic patterns, mm-hmm. and radio work, that would relieve some of the stress, and you can concentrate more on just the...
Learning how to fly the helicopter, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I would think one big thing for fixed wing pilot then is not to come into it with any preconceived ideas of where they should be at.
Yeah.
Think of it as starting a whole new skill.
Exactly, because you gave the example of a tail dragger. You are working those pedals a lot more. I mean, you need to actually give that pressure back and forth.
Yeah.
So if you get a guy that has lots of tail dragger time, and he gets into a helicopter thinking he needs to work those rudder pedals, it doesn't work quite the same.
He'd be doing 360.
Yeah. You know, the rudder pedals, for example, the anti-torque pedals, I should say. Sorry, I'm already thinking fixing. The guy getting in there, what I would tell them is, in our counterclockwise rotating main rotors, like in the U.S.
Okay,
right. We'll talk about the other ones. your nose is always going to whip to the right, because it wants to go opposite because of the torque effect. Every action equal and opposite reaction, right?
Right.
The nose
right.
wants to whip to the right. So what I would tell them on the pedals is, if you want the nose to the right, just relieve some pressure off the left pedal, but keeping a little pressure on the right to make sure it just doesn't jam over, and let the nose go to the right.
Okay.
And again, this is, again, basic level. If there's wind and stuff,
right.
That gets more advanced. If you want the nose to go back to the left or to stop, then you just give that pressure to the left pedal. You're not going back and forth like
right.
you would on the rudder pedals on the tail dragger.
And it just varies. You're right. With tail draggers, it tends to be pretty...
You need to play with it.
Yeah, and very positive movements, whereas the helicopter's more subtle movements.
And let the helicopter do a lot of its work for you.
But I mean, if you want to charge me for this instruction given time, you know, feel free.
No.
Cool. I know this is for anybody flying helicopters, it's probably pretty basic stuff. But for a fixed-wing guy, this stuff is... if you get in a helicopter, it is different, actually, manipulating the controls.
Yeah. Well, we all had to start somewhere, and I guess I was also lucky, though, because I didn't have a lot of fixed wing time, so a lot of things weren't ingrained, so right. I don't know what it would be like being a high-time fixed wing guy going to helicopters other than what I've seen.
Right.
You know, just the students that I've had that came in, and they were high-time fixed-wing pilots, and they came in. I saw some of the difficulties, but they still worked it out.
Right, and it's most of it. Again, don't go into it with preconceived mm-hmm. ideas. Probably the and some of that's hard to do. Like practicing auto rotations, the movement's so alien to a fixed-wing pilot mm-hmm. that it's hard to even get over. Like you want to glide or. Other interesting concepts is thinking of the whole rotor as a disc, mm-hmm. and that's how you get your propulsion forward is from this tilting the rotor. And then these are things that you know, I'm kind of like, that's just cool mm-hmm. that this whole thing's a disc, and you start thinking about it, you know, rotating. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, let's get on to the work side of stuff.
Okay.
Enough basic instruction.
Yeah, yeah.
So you finished up all your ratings, and then you started instructing for Alpine Air.
Yeah. So it was kind of worked out. Pretty good. You know, I consider myself lucky because I had my commercial, but then I had kind of take a financial break for a little while.
Right.
And so that was 2007 when I had my commercial. And then I didn't start instructing until late 2008. I had to work for a while and, you know, kind of lick the wounds, you could
yeah.
say.
Yeah. Beef up the bank account again.
Yeah. And so in summer of 2008, I went down south, actually, to... a school called Glacier Aviation in Olympia.
Yep.
And because at the time I was working as a mechanics helper at Penn Air, and they had the right seat position in the caravan, right? And so I had my private fixed wing, and being that I worked there and I was talking to everybody, I knew that some hiring was going to come up for the right seat, and I knew it paid chump, but at least I get to fly.
Right.
So I was like, all right, well, helicopters might have to go on hold, and I'll knock out my fixed wing license really quick and then jump in the right seat and do that for a while. At least I'm flying.
And you're building time.
Building time, flying. Yeah, exactly. So I went down south because none of the schools in Anchorage could knock out what I wanted to accomplish within the time that I was looking for to make that class.
Right.
And the school down south was highly recommended, so I went down there. Well, midway through the summer, I spent 2.5 months down there. Midway through the summer, they said, the class went away, and that was the same 2008 when the economy started tanking.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, well, I'm down here. They have airplanes and helicopters. I crunched the numbers again really quick, and I said, okay, well, maybe I'll just... I was able to... Well, let me back up. I was able to get my commercial fixed wing without the instrument, so I just had that. So a lot of the time was there.
Right.
And because sure. I already had it from helicopter and some of the requirements.
Yeah, the requirements were there. You just needed to get the lessons.
Mm-hmm. And I had some instrument training, so that worked towards the helicopter. So when I decided to go jump into the helicopter for the instrument, I only needed the minimum of 15 hours, if I remember correctly. I think it is 15. And the CFI, I already had the time. I was going to be right there at like 200 hours in the helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
So because I was able to, you know, make the finances and the time worked, I actually ended up doing my instrument on Saturday and then my CFI on Sunday, you know, back to back. It worked out great. And I went back to Alaska at the end of the summer. I went to Keith and I said, hey, I know you don't have any positions open right now, but, I got my CFI, you know, I was able to get my commercial airplane, heli, and all that kind of stuff too, just to show that, you know, hey, I'm still charging ahead and here I am.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he knew who I was because I had worked for the summer of 2007, I had worked ground support. So not only he knew who I was as a student, but he knew who I was
for Alpine Air.
Yeah, Alpine Air. And so I did all that. And he's like, okay, yeah, we don't have anything right now, but if you want to teach ground or whatever, we can, you know, we'll give you a call if needed. And then a couple months later, sure enough, he said, yeah, we can take you on. And then from there on out, I was instructing for about 2.5 years.
That explains when I asked you if you did your fixed wing first or whether you thought there was an advantage of doing a fixed wing and then switching over, when you said you did, you kind of did fixed wing first in a roundabout way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was all jumbled in there.
Yeah.
And I look at it, and the way I did it, like I said earlier, I really consider myself lucky because... After instructing, and seeing these fixed-wing guys come in trying to get their helicopter license, it's real difficult for them to put that to use more times than not. I have right. seen some success cases. Some guys that, you know, they know somebody or the right place at the right time, they yep. were able to get a job with low time in the helicopter. But usually that's unheard of for the most part.
That's what I've heard that consistently too, and that's one reason I haven't pursued helicopters. That'd be starting basically no matter how much fixed wing time you have, you're kind of starting off mm-hmm. from scratch. Mm-hmm. With the only advantage being you kind of understand the aviation industry, mm-hmm. but you still have to know somebody.
Yeah, and where if you got your helicopter licenses first, it's generally cheaper to go back and do your fixed wing afterwards. So where usually with the fixed wing, the initial jobs you have don't pay all that great.
Yeah.
And on top of, well, not to say the helicopter ones always pay that great, but when you're talking about like the flight instruction differences, if you're trying to be dual rated, it's a lot more difficult to get to that point.
Right.
If you're fixed wing going to helicopter, because, you know, the helicopter, I think it's the same with fixed wing too. It's been a while since I looked at it, but I think it's 55 hours for a commercial add-on if you already have one or the other.
Yeah, I think that's
and right. so, and I saw some guys come out with their commercial at 55 or around that number, right? And they're studs and they did good.
And put a concentrated amount of time into it mm-hmm. and start dragging it out.
Yeah, and then they get their CFI. Maybe they have their CFI with less than 100 hours in helicopters.
Right.
And that's fine. That's, you know, they could be really good. The time isn't the big thing. But it is if you're instructing in Robinson's.
Right.
Because Robinson's the most common flight instruction helicopter out there.
Yep.
And so you need to have 200 hours first. And so a lot of people, they sit there and twiddle their thumbs because what can I do now? Because how am I going to get the money to pay for another 100 hours of just flying around in the patch?
Right.
To get to the point where I can instruct.
$300 an hour.
Yeah. Where if you have a helicopter license already and then you get to add on the airplane, well, you could probably go get a CFI job with, you know, 100 hours or so.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, because if they see your helicopter time, at least you have some experience.
That's interesting. See, being a fixed wing, I've always thought about it as going the other way. I never thought about do your rotorcraft and then do the fixed wing add-on. Mm-hmm.
And, that's what seems to work out best. And I can see the frustration in some guys that I would follow up on later or that I'd hear about just in the local industry.
Right.
That they're not doing anything.
Right.
I mean, I can see how frustrating that would be after shelling out X amount of money.
70 grand.
Yeah.
A lot of these places.
Yeah.
Or more.
Well, 70 if you're starting from like zero to say 200 hours.
Right.
If you're doing the add-on, it's probably going to be half of that.
Okay, that's still a lot. That,
I'm not trying to cheapen the amount, but I'm saying it's...
Yeah, but that it does save, definitely save some.
Yeah.
Huh.
And so it can definitely be frustrating. And like I said, I got lucky because I was able to work it both directions. I was able to use the time that I had towards whatever I was working on at the time, and everything kind of worked out.
Right. Well, and you also... you'd be shocked how many people say, I was lucky to get this first job, or mm-hmm. I was lucky to get this. You're a mechanics helper at Penn Air. You did ground support for Alpine Air. The fact is, you were in the industry, mm-hmm. and that's why you had the chance to have things work out. Mm-hmm. That's what it seems to me, is that everyone is lucky. They're lucky because they put themselves in a spot where, when the opportunity was there, they could take it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Alpine Air guys knew who you were from working for them and doing your training there.
Mm-hmm. And that was a great experience. I liked, like I said, I flight instructed for them for about 2.5 years. So that was a lot of fun. And then the last year that I was there, I double dutied with their 135 operations once I had enough hours to do that.
And they do tours, and they also do some heli skiing stuff, right?
I believe they're getting into heli skiing now. When I was there, he didn't.
Okay.
But now that he has the A-Star, I believe that he's getting more into it. Well, when I was leaving, they were just getting that A-Star into heli-skiing, so it was kind of new.
So they have an A-Star, and I've got to go talk to him, too. That's an interesting operation. The fact that he started off with, you know, 185s flying Glacier stuff, and he obviously switched to helicopters mm-hmm. because probably because he wanted to fly helicopters.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
So you did a couple years with them, primarily flight instructing, a little bit of 135 scenic tours.
Tours, and only a couple of the... like charters.
Okay, and that was all in a 44.
Mm-hmm.
And then you heard about the job at Bering Air?
Yeah, just by chance. I was very happy with Alpine Air. Even though some people say Keith can rub them the wrong way, I had no problem with Keith. I liked working for him.
Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't remember me, but I met him in the coffee shop there quite a few times.
Yeah, I had no problem. I liked how he was very meticulous, anal, obsessive. That stuff didn't bother me. I was fine. You know, if he didn't like something I did and he told me, I was like, all right, that'll change. But I enjoyed working for him. I think that was kind of the military background, too.
Yeah, yep.
But no, my friend just texted me out of the blue. And he said, hey, Bering Air's hiring. They're looking for a dual-rated pilot. They want somebody with primarily helicopter time, Robinson time. Huh. And then also they want somebody with their multi. And I was like, all right. So I looked at the posting. And like I said, I was in no hurry to leave Alpine Air. So, you know, I looked at it. And I didn't have my multi-engine at the time. And I didn't have the fixed wing requirements they wanted because I only had like 300 hours.
Right.
But I had the helicopter requirements. And I went back and forth. I said, yeah, it sounds cool talking to my wife. And then I kind of backed off. And then finally I just wrote a cover letter and resume. Did one up and I sent it up here. And a couple weeks later, Ben called. And then we talked over the phone a few times and then set up a date for an interview to come up.
Huh.
And came up from the interview and then... A couple months later, I came up here, and I told, when I told Keith that I was leaving, you know, he was like, okay, well, I'm bummed, but I understand why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And
I don't know what the pay was there, but Bering Air generally knows to, I mean, they're known to pay well, and they're an excellent company.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so a different profile, but here you work heavy in the summers, and you get a lot of time off in the winter.
Yeah, well, I mean, initially, because they wanted a dual-rated pilot, I was a co-pilot in the 1900.
Okay.
And so that was to keep me busy in the wintertime or if helicopter work was slow.
Right.
And that first year, that's pretty much what happened. But then last summer, we got incredibly busy in the helicopters where I was just nonstop. And they were going to put me in the caravan.
Right.
But every time that they want to send me down to Anchorage to go fly up Ryan, you know, in the simulator at UAA... More work came up in the helicopter, so it happened three different times last year, and each time, you know, I ended up going somewhere else, so the caravan got put on hold, and this winter, it was I didn't do any airplane flying
right.
for Bering Air, and it was mellow, just...
So you stayed with the helicopter?
Stayed in Nome, and, you know, there's still talk of the caravan, but we'll see how this year pans out later in the fall, who knows.
Would you view this as kind of as your progression, and this is like your second flying job, as a helicopter guy, is this kind of a natural progression, or is this kind of, you've gone on a, this does seem a little bit different. Most helicopters I go, they generally just stick with helicopters, mm-hmm. whereas you're definitely at a company where you can fly fixed, they might put you in a caravan.
Mm-hmm.
Is that not the industry standard, do you think, or is that kind of a industry norm?
I would guess it's not the standard from what I've seen.
Okay.
And again, it's a limited experience, but I would think it's not because you don't see very many companies that have airplanes on helicopters.
Right.
Off the top of my head, I can't really think of, you know, Talkeetna Air Taxi, they just got an R-44, but that's new.
Do you know Will?
I've met him a couple times, but I know Danielle.
Okay, yeah.
She was one of my students.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Awesome.
So she's great.
Yeah, I flew for TAT once.
Okay.
And I've met, they're fantastic.
Yeah, Danielle is awesome to fly with us. They had called me and asked me if I could come down and do some sling training and just 135 prep with them. Unfortunately, the schedule up here didn't mesh because I was really hoping to go down to Talkeetna for a while and play with those guys.
And Roderick, I mean, they're good people.
Yeah.
Yeah, Danielle, talk about a good mechanic.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
She is awesome.
Yeah, I like her pacer. Cool-looking plane. Yeah.
Yeah, with the bolt-on alternator and the whole electrical system. So if she wants to lighten it up, she can just...
I guess I don't know about that. Yeah.
Oh, she's got that thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, customized. And then her RB4 is awesome.
Yeah.
So, anyway, yeah.
But, yeah, I would think that this is...
Not quite the norm.
Yeah, it's not the norm. Because, like you said, a lot of people usually just want to stick to one or the other, it seems like. You know, we hired a new helicopter pilot, seasonal guy, who has no fixed wing time at all. He's just helicopter, and he has no interest in airplanes. And that's fine. I mean, everybody's different.
Yeah.
And so...
So
you see that personality out there?
Yeah, so you're, and that's like the guys I know don't have any fixed wing time. They want to fly helicopters. Mm-hmm. And one guy talked to me early on, I was saying, you know, get dual rated, and he didn't have any interest in that. He was, nope, I'm going to fly helicopters. Mm-hmm. The work here at Bering Air, how does it compare to your work at Alpine Air? You're not flying tourists. This is all,
95% of it is all just rural charters. We do the occasional tours.
Okay.
But that's not our mainstay like it is at Alpine Air.
Well, here you're flying biologists. Mm-hmm. Do you fly like a gold mine people at all?
Or? Yeah, so what I would always tell people is we fly a lot of the ologists. Biologists, geologists, archaeologists.
Got it.
Natural science type Got people. It. And, yeah, so I'll fly people out to do some claim staking, to do some kind of geological, you know, digging, surveying, yeah. Stuff like that. Okay. Archaeologists, when they're looking at sites, looking at something of interest.
And you were doing some longlining sling loading down in Unicleat.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't for either of any of the ologists.
No, that was for contractors.
Okay.
That are building towers for GCI, telecommunication okay. company up here.
So you've got a mix of everything. I mean, you're sling loading and you're flying people around landing on the mm-hmm. ridgetops. And,
yep.
How much time do you spend in Nome? How much away from Nome and Unicleat, let's say, or at work camps?
Well, in the past 2 years, the first summer was a little slower, but it was probably 50-50 last summer. I was probably gone about 80% of the time.
Okay.
Maybe.
That seems normal for helicopter work.
Yeah. Yeah. To find yourself outside of your home base, you know, out in some yeah. rural location. Yeah. Pretty common.
Cool. And we talked about this a little before you went. So, Ben, if you're listening, or Russell, we're not implying Corey's going to go anywhere, but if, like from here, and I know you have no intention of leaving Bering Air anytime soon, but if you were looking at other jobs, where is there like a, is there a vertical progression in the helicopter world? And my thing has always been once you get to turbines, which you're in now,
mm-hmm.
With these 500s, which we'll go back and talk about those, everything's kind of a lateral move, and you're looking at more lifestyle change, but there's not, you don't want to, you're not going to a 747.
Mm-hmm.
And some people want to fly A-stars, but nobody, people, helicopter pilots aren't looking for the bigger helicopter. That's not always better.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were going to look around, what type of jobs, other helicopter flying jobs, are you interested in?
Well, I'll tell you the same thing I told everybody at my interview when I came up here over 2 years ago. If I hypothetically was looking for another job, or I wanted another job, I guess the dream job being dual rated, that I think sounds a lot of fun.
Oh yeah,
is to fly for Cal Fire.
Oh.
And I don't even know if it's possible. It just looks interesting. That's kind of what I'm going off of.
Yeah, yeah.
And because they operate Hueys, different models of the Hueys, which just sounds fun to fly. So I'd like the twin engine, the night vision, all that kind of experience, the sling loading with the buckets and whatnot. So it still incorporates everything. But the other really cool thing, fixed wing side, is they fly OV-10 Broncos.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just going off of that looks cool to fly.
Oh, it's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, we're talking in a hypothetical world. That looks like it would be fun. I really don't know too much about it. I haven't done too much research because I'm, you know, I have no intention of going anywhere anytime soon. But it yeah. looks really cool. So that'd be the closest answer I could give you.
I've done a lot of research into fire suppression in general, mm-hmm. and Cal Fire is probably one of the bigger state-run fire departments. And I think it's run by Dynamic. Is it run by Dynamic? And it's contract. They contract the pilots out, so you work for, at least the fixed wing, you mm-hmm. work for, you don't work for the state. You're mm-hmm. a contract pilot. Patty Wagstaff, you know,
I've heard the name, yeah.
Yeah, she won the U.S. Aerobatic Championship like 10 times. She flies for Cal Fire.
Okay.
And evidently in the interview, they're like, you know, this is an aerobatic line. Mm-hmm. You know, why do you think you're qualified? And she's like, well, I know it's totally different than what I've been doing, but I think I can learn it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was flying the Bronco, which...
Nice.
I don't know if when you were in the military, when I was in, the Broncos were still used a lot. So we'd look up overhead from, you know, sit in the desert, and you'd see an OV-10 flying around. And I was always just like, that's...
Yeah.
That's an awesome airplane.
No, they weren't any... And active service when I came in, but I hear they're going to start building them. Some company got an STG or STC, and it's going to start building them new. STC, what a tech certificate.
Tech, yep. Yep,
that's what I meant, yeah.
Yeah, that would, that's a good place to go. The what I've seen with all the fire suppression is you don't actually fly that much.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of standby time.
And that's the downside, yeah.
That is. That's always been for me. I love the flying. But a lot of the fire bombers, they're flying about 200 hours a year.
Mm-hmm.
That's counting training, repositioning airplanes. So there's a lot of sitting around.
Yeah, I have a friend who was working for the North Soapboro up in Barrow. And they have one or two Bell 412s.
He was doing the search and rescue?
Yeah, search and rescue. And then they have the Lear and the King Air.
Yep.
And I thought that always sounded interesting, but same thing as he only flew like 200 hours a year. And as interesting as, say, like the Cal Fire, that would definitely be kind of the cruncher because as fun as it would be while I fly, I want to stay active.
Right, yeah.
I get very restless if I'm just sitting still.
I'm with you. I always say they're flying jobs that are about the flying,
mm-hmm.
and they're flying jobs that are kind of about, I don't want to say not flying, that's kind of negative, but they're not, they're just kind of about the job and a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds kind of negative, but I love the firebombing work, the idea of it, but the sitting around would kill me.
Yeah.
I probably just didn't have any chance of getting a job flying for any of those guys. It is cool flying, you're doing good work, but yeah, it's hard. The search and rescue, I got up to fly in the Bell, then they're 214 once.
Oh, yeah.
We put a 207 in a river, so they picked us up.
Oh, okay.
But it was awesome. That's a cool helicopter.
One of the things I'd love to do at some point, even if it's just a training like they offer in, say, Hawaii or whatever, is flying with night vision on.
Yeah.
In the military, you know, I probably have hundreds of hours of walking and driving with night vision on.
Okay.
So I always thought it'd be interesting to fly with it.
What was your MOS in the military?
Infantry.
And just a straight infantry? Yeah. I've got a good buddy who I always give him shit because he's a climbing guy now, but he was a Green Beret and a Ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And he's always like, oh, I didn't do anything interesting. I'm like, dude, you were a Green Beret and a Ranger. It's like, how cool is that? That's cool. But anyway, that's sort of a digression there. Any thoughts or recommendations you give to someone who wants to get into a helicopter flying career? And touch on the dual-rated aspects, whether you think that's what, you know, the interesting aspects of flying two different types of
mm-hmm.
aircraft versus specializing in one.
I mean, if you want diversity and you want to keep busy, say, in the wintertime and the off-season, being dual-rated helps. If, you know, in environments such as this where helicopter work really slows down, if not completely stops at times, being dual-rated helps. But in terms of just I guess what I would say is, if I can do it, anybody can do it. In terms of, just going out and what you want to do, I would say if you can come up with the time and money, because hopefully if you're already thinking about it, you have the motivation. If you can come up with the time and money, then try to do helicopter first. If your goal is to do dual rate it, and then do fixed wing after. But I guess, you know, just go with what you feel comfortable with, what you enjoy. And, I'll say it again. I mean, if I can do it, anybody can do it.
You know, I just realized I always do this where I think I'm done, and then I part of the winter work, you've thought about doing winter flying in, like, New Zealand or Australia, like a good mix Ryanair, or Bering Air, in the summer, and then go down to the Southern Hemisphere and fly down there. Have you done any serious looking into that? Or
not really. It just sounds fun.
It does sound
fun. Truthfully, I don't think that schedule would fly with Bering Air.
Because they want someone manning the helicopter.
Yeah, year-round, or just, you know, fixing and whatnot.
Right.
But it's one of those things that just sounds interesting, sounds a lot of fun. And if it were to happen and all parties were happy with it, I would definitely take the opportunity and do it.
Right.
But again, I wouldn't leave anybody holding the bag and just say, this is what I'm doing,
right.
See you. Hopefully I'll see you in a couple months. I would never do that.
I've got both the guys I know who started flying helicopter, they're both probably around, well, actually, one guy's flying in Florida now, he's probably pushing 1,000 hours, I bet. I think both of them be interested in like heli skiing type job, like seasonal work. Mm-hmm. Do you know a good path to get into like a heli skiing gig? Is there a normal progression there?
From again my limited experience of what I've seen, it seems like you would want to. You already have a good standing with, say, somebody that does that type of operations. Like right. Heliskiing, everybody thinks that's a lot of fun and whatnot, but what they don't often think about, it's real dangerous too.
Right.
And when we're talking about heliskiing, because you got high altitude, you got winds, you got people that don't know how to operate around helicopters a lot of time, you know, just regular Joe off the street.
Yeah.
So to get into that, the operators usually want to see somebody that has, you know, a lot of high altitude, bad weather kind of experience. So
okay.
Not knocking the pilots to say are coming from Florida. You know, they're just as capable and just as skilled, but
they don't have the experience.
They don't have the experience, yeah, and so somebody might overlook. They may have tons of flying experience,
right?
But they probably don't have that adverse conditions kind of experience.
So they need to go with a company that, I know like Aera Helicopters, not Aera Fixed Wing.
Mm-hmm.
They do scenic tours a lot, and they also do some heli skiing.
Mm-hmm.
And probably their heli ski pilots got a job flying the tours.
Yes.
And did that for a few years
yeah.
before moving in.
Same with Alpine Air now. If they're doing heli skiing, you know, you're going to fly tours for a while. That's going to be your progression. So, yeah, you take that guy from Florida, they're not going to go probably straight into heli skiing.
Right.
They'll okay. probably do something else to get to that point.
Got it.
That's what it seems like, at least.
And then the 500. Bering Air just picked up two at I always get it wrong. They used to be MD-500, Hughes 500s. Now they're the MD-500s?
Yes, they're MD-500s.
Okay.
Yep.
And you just picked up two.
Mm-hmm.
Your first experience with turbine helicopters.
Yep.
What do you think?
It's fun. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different than the Robinson, since all my time up to this has been Robinson's. They're just fun in their own different way. Nothing negative to say about it, because what it does, it seems to do really well. You know, slinging, now the limited slinging that I've done in it so far, seems great. It's a real stable platform.
Okay.
And compared to the R-44.
Right.
Not saying the R-44 is unstable, but it's just a little jumpier with the hydraulically assisted controls as
right.
opposed to what's in the 500. But, yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm anxious to continue flying it, and hopefully have a busy summer season with it.
Is that a hard transition from the 44 to the 500?
Just systems.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't feel like I had too difficult of a time going from one to the other.
Cool.
Because the basic principle is still there on the helicopter.
Right.
You know, it's not like jumping in, say, a Robinson to, say, an A-Star, where the blade's turning a different direction, so your mind has to think about different pedals.
Right.
You're still reacting, going back to what I said way at the beginning, you still should be reacting to what you see outside, but you still have to anticipate, obviously, there's that difference. But with these helicopters, it still pretty much operates the same. The basic principles there, it's just the systems are different.
Okay, that makes sense. And the final question, the whole reason I even heard about you mm-hmm. was the rescue at Osborne.
Oh, yeah.
And I sat down with Jim West and Larry Eggert talked about it from their side. I know you've been involved in some other rescues, and it seems like helicopters are involved with rescues more often.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually a pretty satisfying thing to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been called in on a couple.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts or feelings on that?
Just like I said, it's great to have that ability to
yeah.
go out and help somebody like that.
Yeah,
it was great to be there and get them off. In this case, it was not Ian.
It was Ian, and I forgot his buddy's name.
Yeah. But yeah, it was great to get him out of the danger
yep.
and get him back. And otherwise, yeah, he would have had a pretty painful trip on the snow machine just to get out of the mountains there.
Well, given how... Yeah, literally could have saved his life,
mm-hmm.
actually, given that he had complications once he even got to Anchorage.
Yeah, I didn't know about that until after the fact. That's interesting.
Yeah, I didn't either until I looked into it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I need to follow up and see how he's doing.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Yeah, hopefully he's doing good.
Yeah, well, if you get to it, we have the interview on the website.
I saw a part of it, yeah.
Yeah, you know the story, so mm-hmm. it wouldn't be that interesting to you, but it seems like one of those rescues where everything went just right.
Mm-hmm.
And do you get, when you get calls on that, they come out of the blue, middle of the night?
Yeah. In this case, it was borderline middle of the night. I mean, it was, I think, 5 in the morning when I first received the first call.
Okay.
And then just the powers that be started working things out throughout the morning. And then when they finally, usually the helicopter is the last thing to go because they want to make sure that if they can get the person out another way, that's going to be cheaper, safer, or whatever. Well, I wouldn't say safer, but cheaper.
Right.
Then they're going to go that route. And I don't want to put a dollar figure on anybody because that's, but I mean, if they can get somebody out where it's going to be safe.
Right.
They're not going to use a helicopter.
Well, and honestly, that's done all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, car wrecks down south, it's always, like, we call the helicopter, and then it is a dollar. I mean, yeah. We hate to say it, but that there is a cost of, mm-hmm. Performing the rescue. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't always, you know, a broken foot, you don't call the helicopter in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there's a cheaper means of doing the rescue, do it. I've flown on the helicopter in Denali, and some of this comes from that. You know, like with guiding and the Rangers on Denali, could they call in the helicopter every time to pull somebody off who sprained an ankle? They could, but they don't because mm-hmm. it's expensive. So there is that side.
Mm-hmm. So this one, they're weighing that throughout the morning.
Right.
After Larry was already on station, or he was heading out there, one of the trucks, the fire truck, was heading out, and people want snow machines. Yeah. And then finally they said, you know, go.
Jim West, and he kind of said that he kind of made that call before the troopers or anybody else was willing to give that call. And he's like, hey, listen, I know where they are. Just the nature of the accident, we're going to need that helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of cool. And then that helicopter can go out and perform those rescues and make the rescue that much more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome.
Yeah, I will butcher the saying, but it's out there, a saying that the helicopter has saved more lives. It's like the only vehicle, aircraft, something like that, that saved more lives than has taken or something like that.
Yeah. That's, well, you look at Korean War. You mm-hmm. know, of course, MASH, the TV show and the movie, is all based on the bringing wounded in by helicopter. I think the helicopter in the Korean War demonstrated on the battlefield how efficient, how many more soldiers you can save, and mm-hmm. limbs you can save, you know, because of that rapid transit.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. All right, on that more sobering note.
Yeah.
We've got a beautiful day here in Nome, and I think it's either time to shoot a video or go out and enjoy the day, one or the other.
Yeah. We'll see what we can accomplish.
So, Aiden with Oddball Pilot. Over and out.